but only after the damage was done. I escaped to LA to record songs for a new album, which was to be a collaboration between Phil Collins and Tom Dowd. I'd asked Tom to co-produce it because I didn't feel confident that Phil really knew my musical background well enough to do the job single-handed, and with Tom involved I felt I could oversee the production. We worked at Sunset Sound Studios in Hollywood, with the basic band consisting of me on guitar, Phil on drums, Greg Fillinganes on keyboards, and Nathan East on bass. The horns, Michael Brecker on sax, Randy Brecker and John Faddis on trumpet, and Dave Bargeron on trombone, were overdubbed in New York, and Tina Turner and I duetted live on Tearing Us Apart. For me, these were pretty drunken sessions, and looking back, I don't know how I got through them. Nigel, who came with me, had rented us a place on Sunset Plaza, and secretly I would drink and do coke until about 6 in the morning. Then at about 11 I would go into the studio and somehow stay sober during the day, so from midday till about 6 in the evening I would try to work while feeling hungover, doing the best I could, until I reached a moment when I felt able to say, "Okay, we've had a great day, let's call it quits," at which point I would drive back to the rented villa and hit the booze and coke again. I hardly slept at all. Of course, I was trying my hardest to hide my drinking from everybody, unsuccessfully as it turned out. Nigel had got me a rental car which didn't have a proper license plate, so some of the crew, unbeknownst to me, had made a tag out of cardboard that read, "Captain Smirnoff." In the months before Laurie's baby was due, I had come to realize that this was the one thing in my life that something good could come of, and I had been making some attempts to restore the relationship with her. On my return from recording in L.A., I went to visit her in Milan a few times, and eventually, a few weeks before the birth, she returned to London, having told me that since I was English, she felt the baby should be born in England. I rented a small house in Chelsea for her, where I used to visit her every day. Connor was born on August the 21st, 1986, at St. Mary's, Paddington. As soon as I heard that Laurie had gone into labour, I rushed to the hospital, determined to be in at the birth, though more than a little frightened of what I was going to experience. As it happened, he got stuck upside down, so they had to perform a last-minute caesarean. They put a screen around the bed, and a nurse came and stood beside me. She told me that men often faint in these situations. I was determined to try and be present for this. I just had an incredible feeling that this was going to be the first real thing that had ever happened to me. Up till that moment, it seemed like my life had been a series of episodes that had very little meaning. The only time it had seemed real was when I was challenging myself in some way with music. Everything else, the drinking, the tours, even my life with Patty, it all had an air of artificiality to it. When the baby finally came, they gave him to me to hold. I was spellbound, and I felt so proud, even though I had no idea how to hold a baby. Laurie spent a couple of days in the hospital. While she was there, I remember going down to Lord's to watch the cricket. The great English cricketer Ian Beefy Botham was playing, whom I knew through David English, former president of the Robert Stigwood Organization, and after the match he raised a glass of champagne to me in honour of Connor's birth. By that time it had begun to sink in that I was a father, and that it was time for me to grow up. I considered all my previous irrational behaviour to have been reasonably excusable, because it had been conducted with consenting adults, whereas with this tiny child, so vulnerable as he was, I suddenly became aware that it was time to try and stop fucking around. But the question was, how? Connor's birth was commemorated with the release of the new album, which I called August, and which turned out to be my biggest-selling solo album to date. It had a hit single in It's in the Way You Use It, which was featured in the Paul Newman film The Colour of Money, and also included Holy Mother, which I had dedicated to Richard Manuel, the great keyboard player of the band, who had hanged himself in March 1986. One song I decided not to include was Lady from Verona, which I had written specially for Laurie. That might have been too much for Patty to bear. Laurie returned to Italy soon after the birth, the idea being that I would go over and visit her and Connor for a few days whenever possible. The problem was that my drinking had become full-blown again, and I was finding it harder and harder to control. I really loved this little boy, and yet, when I went to visit him in Milan, I would sit and play with him in the daytime, and every second of that time, all I could think about was how much longer it would be before Laurie would arrive to feed him and take him away to bed so that I could have another drink. I never drank in his presence. I would stay white-knuckle sober all the time he was awake, but as soon as she had put him in his cot, I would get back to my normal consumption, drinking until I passed out. I did this every night until I went back to England. The company I was hanging out with during this period certainly did little to curb my excesses. Back in 1986, and throughout the summer of 87, for example, I spent a lot of time with Beefy Botham and David English, and the three of us would go on mad sprees. David had been a friend since RSO days, and between us we had formed the EC11, which later evolved into the Banburys, a ragtag team of musicians and sportsmen who liked to play cricket for fun, and although some of us would take it fairly seriously, I for one treated it as another excuse for a grand piss-up. Sometimes I would just drive up to watch Beefy play for his county, Worcestershire. He's a wonderful man, very gregarious and generous, a great player and a natural leader with a scaldingly cruel sense of humour. More often than not, poor David would be the recipient of our scornful attention and suffer extraordinary abuse at our hands, much as Stiggy had with Ahmet and Earl. We were pretty merciless, but I just loved watching Beefy play, and drove all over the country to watch first-class county games. Drinking is a big part of the cricket social scene, and Beefy liked the odd quencher too, so I fit right in. This, then, was the pattern of my life over the next year, which reached its climax when I was touring Australia in the autumn of 1987. By then there had been such an erosion of my capabilities that I couldn't stop shaking. For the second time I'd reached the point where I couldn't live without a drink and I couldn't live with one. I was a mess, and so far as my playing was concerned, I was just about scraping by. One day, cooped up in my hotel room, a long way from home with nothing to think about but my own pain and misery, I suddenly knew that I had to go back into treatment. I thought to myself, this has got to stop. I really did it for Connor, because I thought no matter what kind of human being I was, I couldn't stand being around him like that. I couldn't bear the idea that, as he experienced enough of life to form a picture of me, it would be a picture of the man I was then. I called Roger and told him to book me into Hazelden again, and on November the 21st, 1987, I went back into treatment. My second visit to Hazelden was, on the face of it, much like the first, but on a deeper level it was very different. This time I had no reservations about why I was there. I had tried to control my drinking and failed, so there was no more debate, no more grey area for me. Also, my life had become very complicated and completely unmanageable during my relapse. I now had two children, neither of whom I was really administering to, a broken marriage, assorted, bewildered girlfriends, and a career that, although it was still ticking over, had lost its direction. I was a mess. My counsellor this time around, a great guy named Phil, having first established a strong bond with me, employed a sort of ridicule method. It threw me completely. I had grown used to people treating me with a certain amount of reverence, maybe just out of fear, and here was this guy laughing at my pomposity and arrogance. I didn't know how to deal with it. It caught me off balance and helped me see myself as others saw me, and it wasn't pretty. I was captivated, and tried to engage him as much as I could, but he was rarely available, or made it seem that way. Like my half-brother Brian, he had something I wanted. More than that, it was something I knew I needed. I was like a blade of grass in the wind. One day I would be blown up, scornful and full of myself, and the next I was in a pit of despair. But I kept coming back to the thought of Connor, the reality of his life and what it required of me, and the horrible possibility that if I didn't get it right this time, history would probably repeat itself. The thought of him going through all that was what finally made the difference. I had to break the chain and give him what I had never really had, a father. Nevertheless, I stumbled through my month in treatment much as I had done the first time, just ticking off the days, hoping that something would change in me without me having to do much about it. Then one day, as my visit was drawing to an end, a panic hit me, and I realized that in fact nothing had changed in me, and that I was going back out into the world again completely unprotected. The noise in my head was deafening, and drinking was in my thoughts all the time. It shocked me to realize that here I was in a treatment center, a supposedly safe environment, and I was in serious danger. I was absolutely terrified, in complete despair. At that moment, almost of their own accord, my legs gave way and I fell to my knees. In the privacy of my room, I begged for help. I had no notion who I thought I was talking to. I just knew that I had come to the end of my tether. I had nothing left to fight with. Then I remembered what I had heard about surrender, something I thought I could never do. My pride just wouldn't allow it, but I knew that on my own I wasn't going to make it, so I asked for help, and getting down on my knees, I surrendered. Within a few days I realized that something had happened for me. An atheist would probably say it was just a change of attitude, and to a certain extent that's true, but there was much more to it than that. I had found a place to turn to, a place I'd always known was there but never really wanted or needed to believe in. From that day until this, I have never failed to pray in the morning on my knees, asking for help, and at night to express gratitude for my life, and, most of all, for my sobriety. I choose to kneel because I feel I need to humble myself when I pray, and with my ego, this is the most I can do. If you're asking why I do all this, I will tell you. Because it works. As simple as that. In all this time that I've been sober, I have never once seriously thought of taking a drink or a drug. I have no problem with religion, and I grew up with a strong curiosity about spiritual matters, but my searching took me away from church and community worship to the internal journey. Before my recovery began, I found my God in music and the arts, with writers like Hermann Hesse, and musicians like Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, and Little Walter. In some way, in some form, my God was always there, but now I have learned to talk to him. I came home from Hazelden for Christmas, to Laurie and Connor at Hurtwood. There was a lot to be done, a lot of wreckage to clear up, and Laurie was very supportive. I think she knew intuitively that I was not ready to make a decision about our situation yet, and seemed reasonably content just to see where things would lead. Funnily enough, the first person I wanted to see on my return was Patty. We had parted on such bad terms, and I wanted to see if there was still a spark there, even if it was only friendship. We met for lunch, and it was great. I couldn't feel any enmity from her, and we were able to speak without manipulation, which for me was a miracle. Shortly before the end of 1987, the phone lady contacted me again, saying she was about to be evicted from her flat and needed money. I can't remember if she said she was pregnant at this time, but I made the mistake of sending her some cash. It was like opening Pandora's box. From that day on, for the next few years, she hounded me. It started in the press in the spring of 1988, with photos of her in the Sunday tabloids appearing to be several months pregnant, and dreadful headlines calling me every name under the sun. It went on for about a month, until someone, a girl who apparently worked for her, contacted the tabloids to say that it was all a hoax. The photos were taken with pillows, and there was no truth in any of it. I later learned that she had foisted the same ruse on a couple of other musicians, but no one had taken the bait until Yours Truly came along, giving truth to the old saying, "There's one in every crowd." The papers issued minuscule apologies, but I was badly shaken. There was, after all, the slim chance that she might really be pregnant, and I was very confused about what my responsibilities would be if that were the case. And all this took place in that first few months after I'd come out of rehab for the second time. Talk about being thrown into the deep end. From time to time over the next few years, the phone lady would reappear, sometimes on the street in broad daylight, screaming things like, "You'll never get away from me!" And for a man who is naturally inclined to fear the opposite sex, this was sometimes more than I could bear. Gradually, though, she faded into the background, until one day I met up with her again in New York. She was with a musician friend of mine whom she had obviously set up home with. I was gobsmacked. I felt that I ought to straighten him out about who she was and what she was capable of. In the end, I left it alone. They seemed very happy, and it looked pretty normal. I just didn't have the heart to rock their boat, and maybe he knew about it all anyway. After coming out of Hazelden, there was work to throw myself back into, beginning with a continuation of a project that had started in January 1986, when I had agreed to play 6 shows on successive nights at the Royal Albert Hall in London. It was to become a tradition, with the number of gigs increasing each year, until they would peak in 1991 with 24. With a band that included Nathan East and Greg Fillinganes from the August sessions, Steve Ferrone and Phil Collins on drums, and the addition of Mark Knopfler on guitar, the performances had gone so well that we decided to try and make it a regular booking. I had always liked this venue, and enjoyed going to see people play there. It's comfortable, has a great atmosphere, and the management has always made sure that it sounds good. It's also one of the few places where you can see all of the audience when you're on stage. You've got fans behind you and all around you in boxes, standing up in the gods and sometimes even in the stalls. The people at the front are right at your feet, so you really feel like you're in among the crowd. I remember when the Royal Albert was off limits to rock music and somehow the Mothers of Invention managed to get booked there. It was a fantastic show, and for an encore, Frank Zappa's keyboard player, Don Preston, known as Mother Don, broke into the hall's organ keyboard, which was locked behind two glass doors, and played a raucous version of Louie Louie that brought the house down. The best times I had in those early years of sobriety were in the company of my son and his mother. It was the closest that life ever got to being normal for me. Connor was a good-looking boy with blonde hair, much the same as mine at the same age, and brown eyes. I'd seen pictures of my Uncle Adrian as a little boy playing in the Ripley Woods with my mother, and he bore a strong resemblance to him. He was a beautiful child with a wonderful, gentle nature who was walking by the time he was a year old. As soon as he could talk, he used to call me Papa. But however deeply I loved this little boy, I had no idea where to begin with him, because I was a baby trying to look after a baby, so I just let Laurie raise him, which she did brilliantly. She would come and stay with her sister Paula, who also worked for her as her assistant, and occasionally their mother accompanied them, and for a few weeks we would live a very peaceful, family kind of life. I used to watch Connor's every move, and because I didn't really know much about how to be a father, I played with him in the way a sibling plays, kicking balls around on the terrace for hours and going for walks in the garden. He also got to know my mother and grandmother and Roger too. Anyone who came into contact with him adored him. He was a little angel, really. A very divine being. In 1989, I began working on one of my own favourite albums, Journeyman. Produced by Russ Titelman, the album contained an interesting mixture of covers and originals, but mainly featured more of Jerry Williams's material. I really loved his writing. In fact, musically, I loved everything about him. He could be a little overwhelming in person, but that was entirely forgivable, given the scale of his talent. He was great to work with, a wonderful guy, very funny, very talented, and I knew we would be friends forever. I had a lot of fun working on this album, which featured, among numerous musicians, playing by George Harrison, Cecil and Linda Womack, and Robert Cray. Russ insisted that I do a version of Hound Dog, which turned out to be a great idea, and a Ray Charles number, Hard Times. But my favourite track was Old Love, a moody blues song I wrote with Robert Cray and on which we shared the guitar playing equally. We took the album out on the road in 1990, first in the UK and Europe, then later across the USA. It was during the second half of this tour, at the end of August, that I lost a good friend and a musical hero. Stevie Ray Vaughan was a Texas guitarist and blues player, the younger brother of Jimmy Vaughan, whom I knew pretty well from his group The Fabulous Thunderbirds. In mid-1986, I had had a call to my office from Jimmy saying that Stevie Ray was in a drying-out clinic in London, and he asked if I would go and see him. I visited Stevie and told him that as someone who had been through all this before, I was there for him if he needed me. We became good friends, and during the following years I saw him play a few times and we occasionally jammed together. At that time, I would say he was one of the greatest electric blues guitarists in the world, with a style very reminiscent of Albert King, who was his hero. On August the 26th, we were playing at a ski resort in Wisconsin, in a venue called the Alpine Valley Music Theatre, between Milwaukee and Chicago. Stevie Ray opened the show with his band Double Trouble, and watching him on the monitor in my dressing room, I remember thinking, man, I've got to top the bill after this. His playing was so fluid. It didn't seem like he was playing to emulate anybody, it just all came straight from him, seemingly without any effort. It was very inventive. And his singing was great, too. He really did have it all. I went on and did my thing, thinking that in the light of someone like Stevie Ray, I was a very eclectic musician, in that I didn't just play blues, I played ballads, reggae, and all kinds of different styles. The blues was in all of the music I performed and in the way I interpreted it. Also on the bill that night were Buddy Guy, Robert Cray, and Stevie Ray's brother Jimmy, and at the end of the show we all jammed together, Stevie Ray included, in a 15-minute version of the song Sweet Home Chicago. When the show was over, we all hugged goodbye and were rushed off to a series of helicopters that were waiting for us. They were the kind of choppers with big Perspex domes, and as soon as we got in, I noticed the pilot using a merchandising T-shirt to clean the windscreen, which was covered in condensation. Outside, a thick wall of fog seemed to hover about 10 feet above the ground, and I recall thinking to myself, this doesn't look right. But I didn't want to say anything in case it promoted fear. After all, the last thing you want on a plane is a crazy person saying, we're all going to die, so I just kept my mouth shut. At that moment, unbeknownst to me, Stevie Ray, who had been due to drive back to Chicago, had found a spare seat on one of the other choppers, along with two of my crew, Nigel Brown and Colin Smythe, and my agent, Bobby Brooks. All four helicopters took off, flying up into a wall of fog. I remember thinking, I hate this sort of thing. And then suddenly we were above the fog, and the sky was clear and we could see the stars. It was a short trip back to the hotel, and I went to bed and had a pretty good night's sleep. About 7 in the morning, I got a call from Roger to say that Stevie Ray's helicopter hadn't come back, and no one yet knew what had happened to it. I went up to his room, where eventually we got the news that it had taken off, turned the wrong way, and flown straight into an artificial ski slope. There were no survivors. Poor Jimmy had to go and identify his brother's body. The rest of the day was spent deliberating about whether or not we should carry on with the tour or cancel it out of respect. The unanimous decision was to carry on, and though we went ahead and played that night's show in St. Louis in a state of shock, it was the best tribute to Stevie Ray we could have made. During the Journeyman recording sessions, I was introduced to a pretty young Italian model named Carla, who, by default, would become my next life teacher. Carla was introduced to me by a friend of Laurie's, which in itself was a little odd, and caused a lot of problems for everyone over the next few months. Initially, I wasn't overly interested, but she was clearly a music fan and seemed quite taken with me. I was very flattered because she was only 21 and very sexy, with long hair, a remarkable figure, and a young-looking face that was slightly Asian, with high cheekbones and almond-shaped eyes. We began dating, and in a very short time I became obsessed with her. I was living in New York while I made the record, and it served as a backdrop for our affair, very fast and very romantic. Carla took me to a great restaurant called Bilboquet, where I met and became friends with a proprietor, Philippe Delgrange. This place was the big hangout for all the rich and fashionable Europeans in New York, and in my naivety, I believed I fit right in. While it was still going strong, the Stones came through town on their Steel Wheels tour, and Carla mentioned that she was a fan of theirs and asked me if I would take her to see them. We went to the show, and afterward I took her backstage to meet the guys. I remember saying to Jagger, "Please, Mick, not this one. I think I'm in love." In the past, he had made several unsuccessful passes at Patty, and I knew Carla would appeal to his eye. For all my pleadings, it was only a matter of days before they started a clandestine affair. In the interim, I went to Africa to play a short tour, starting in Swaziland and going on to Botswana, Zimbabwe, and Mozambique. On my return, I visited Carla's family home in Saint-Tropez, where I got a fairly chilly reception from Carla, but also got the chance to meet a couple of her previous boyfriends. They seemed like great guys and commiserated with me on my plight, implying that Carla tended to move through men quite quickly, sometimes quite ruthlessly. A short while later, after Carla had stood me up a couple of times, I got a call from the girl who had introduced us, telling me that Carla was definitely seeing Mick, and it was serious. I had heard rumours, and now apparently it was true. The obsession gripped me for the rest of that year and took some grisly turns when I found myself guesting with the Stones on a couple of shows, knowing that she was lurking somewhere in the background. What did I learn from Carla? Not much at the time, but as time passed, I learned to differentiate between lust and love, and a little bit later between pleasure and happiness. To her credit, once the seduction was complete, she didn't continue to lead me on, and at no time did she ever really express any deep feelings for me, but in my madness I was able to convince myself that this was the love of my life. The deception involved in her affair with Jagger drove a deep wedge between me and him, and for a while I found it hard to think of him without malice. Later on, of course, I quietly felt both gratitude and compassion toward him, first for delivering me from certain doom, and second for apparently suffering such prolonged agony in her service. Prompted by my obsession with Carla and Mick, I began to do some proper recovery work. For a start, it was deemed necessary by my sponsor that a fourth-step inventory be taken on the subject of my resentment toward them both. The fourth step is generally practiced as an honest review of the past, in order to identify the alcoholic's own contribution to his drinking problems. It can also be applied to specific situations in sobriety where the lines of responsibility have become confused. It is generally symptomatic that alcoholics believe everything is being done to them, and that they are victims with no control over their own lives. In terms of their ability to stop drinking, this is undoubtedly true, but in every other respect it can be changed or modified as they take more responsibility. This is part of what the steps are for. It came as a big surprise to me, therefore, to find out that I needn't have actually got into the relationship with Carla in the first place. I thought that it was something I had to do, and that I was compelled. What I found, as I worked through step four, was that I had chosen to do it. It was where I wanted to go and what I wanted to do. I didn't look at the reality of the situation at all, and with only 2 years of sobriety under my belt, I had very little notion of what was good for me. I found a pattern in my behaviour that had been repeating itself for years, decades even. Bad choices were my specialty, and if something honest and decent came along, I would shun it or run the other way. It could be argued that my choices reflected the way I saw myself, that I thought I wasn't worthy of anything decent, so I could only choose partners who would ultimately abandon me, as I was convinced my mother had done all those years ago. I did not run away from Connor, even though there was to begin with a certain amount of fear involved in my relationship with him. I was, after all, a part-time father. Small children can be quite dismissive and unintentionally cruel, and I tended to take this very personally. However, as the time of my sobriety increased, I began to be more comfortable with him and to really look forward to seeing him. I was very much in this mood in March 1991, when I'd arranged to see Connor in New York, where Laurie and her new boyfriend Silvio were planning to buy an apartment. On the evening of March 19th, I went to the Galleria, an apartment block on West 57th Street, where they were staying, to pick up Connor and take him to the circus on Long Island. It was the very first time I had taken him out on my own, and I was both nervous and excited. It was a great night out. Connor never stopped talking and was particularly excited at seeing the elephants. It made me realize for the first time what it meant to have a child and be a father. I remember telling Laurie when I took him back that from then on, when I had Connor home on visits, I wanted to look after him all on my own. The following morning I was up early, ready to walk cross town from my hotel, the Mayfair Regent, on Park and 64th Street, to pick up Laurie and Connor, to take them to the Central Park Zoo, followed by lunch at Bice, my favorite Italian restaurant. At about 11 a.m, the phone rang, and it was Laurie. She was hysterical, screaming that Connor was dead. I thought to myself, this is ridiculous. How can he be dead? And I asked her the silliest question, are you sure? And then she told me that he'd fallen out of the window. She was beside herself, screaming. I said, I'll be right there. I remember walking up Park Avenue, trying to convince myself that everything was really all right, as if anyone could make a mistake about something like that. When I got near the apartment building, I saw a police line and paramedics on the street, and I walked past the scene, lacking the courage to go in. Finally, I went into the building, where I was asked a few questions by the police. I took the elevator upstairs to the apartment, which was on the 53rd floor. Laurie was out of her mind and talking in a crazy way. By this time I had become very calm and detached. I had stepped back within myself and become one of those people who just attend to others. By talking to the police and the doctors, I established what had happened without even having to go into the room. The main sitting room had windows down one side that went from floor to ceiling, and that could be cantilevered open for cleaning. There were no window guards, however, since the building was a condominium and escaped the normal building regulations. On this morning, the janitor was cleaning the windows and had temporarily left them open. Connor was racing about the apartment, playing a game of hide-and-seek with his nanny, and while Laurie was distracted by the janitor warning her about the danger, he simply ran into the room and straight out the window. He then fell 49 floors, before landing on the roof of an adjacent four-story building. There was no way that Laurie was going to come down to the mortuary, so I had to go and identify him on my own. Whatever physical damage he had suffered in the fall, by the time I saw him, they had restored his body to some normality. As I looked at his beautiful face in repose, I remember thinking, "This isn't my son. It looks a bit like him, but he's gone." I went to see him again at the funeral home to say goodbye to him and to apologize for not being a better father. A few days later, accompanied by various friends and family, Laurie and I flew back to England with the coffin. We went back to Hurtwood, where the Italians all wailed, openly expressing their grief, while I remained quite detached, in a permanent daze. Connor's funeral took place at St. Mary Magdalene's Church in Ripley, on a cold, bleak March day, shortly before my 46th birthday. All the Ripleyites came, and it was a very lovely service. But I was speechless. I looked up at his coffin, and I just couldn't talk. We laid him to rest in a plot right next to the wall of the church, and as his coffin was lowered into the ground, his Italian grandmother became completely hysterical and tried to throw herself into the grave. I remember feeling a bit shocked by this, as I'm not very good at outward emotion. I just don't grieve that way. When we came out of the churchyard, we were faced with a wall of reporters and photographers, about 50 of them. The curious thing is that while a lot of other people were very upset and insulted because they considered this to be a lack of respect, it didn't impinge on my own grief in any way. I just didn't care. All I wanted was for it all to be over. After the funeral, when Laurie's family had all gone home and Hurtwood was quiet, and it was just me alone with my thoughts, I found a letter from Connor that he had written for me from Milan, telling me how much he missed me and was looking forward to seeing me in New York. He had written, "I love you." Heartbreaking though it was, I looked upon it as a positive thing. There were thousands of letters of condolence for me to read, written from all over the world, from friends, from strangers, from people like the Kennedys and Prince Charles. I was amazed. One of the first I opened was from Keith Richards. It just said, "If there's anything I can do, just let me know." I'll always be grateful for that. I cannot deny that there was a moment when I did lose faith, and what saved my life was the unconditional love and understanding that I received from my friends and my fellows in the 12-step program. I would go to a meeting and people would just quietly gather round and keep me company, buy me coffee and let me talk about what had happened. I was asked to chair some meetings, and at one of these sessions, when I was doing a chair on the third step, which is about handing your will over to the care of God, I recounted the story of how, during my last stay in Hazelden, I had fallen upon my knees and asked for help to stay sober. I told the meeting that the compulsion was taken away at that moment, and as far as I was concerned, this was physical evidence that my prayers had been answered. Having had that experience, I said, I knew I could get through this. A woman came up to me after the meeting and said, "You've just taken away my last excuse to have a drink." I asked her what she meant. I said, "I've always had this little corner of my mind which held the excuse that if anything were to happen to my kids, then I'd be justified in getting drunk. You've shown me that's not true." I was suddenly aware that maybe I had found a way to turn this dreadful tragedy into something positive. I really was in the position to say, "Well, if I can go through this and stay sober, then anyone can." At that moment I realized that there was no better way of honoring the memory of my son. The aftermath. The first few months after Connor's death were a waking nightmare, but the condition of shock prevented me from completely breaking down. I also had work commitments to deal with. To begin with, Russ Titelman was sitting in a studio with a pile of tapes from the 24 shows I had done at the Royal Albert Hall in February and March. I couldn't engage with the music at all and didn't really want to be there until he played me the version of Wonderful Tonight. For some reason, listening to that song had a very calming effect on me, and I went into a deep sleep. I hadn't slept for weeks until then, so it was a very healing experience. I think it was because the song took me back to a reasonably sane and uncomplicated point in my past, where all I had to worry about was my partner being late getting ready for dinner. Back in the present, I bought a house in London and built a house in Antigua. I couldn't stand sitting alone in Hurtwood after what had happened, so I asked one of my oldest friends, Vivian Gibson, to come around every day to check on the mail. Viv and I had been friends for many years, having started out when we had an affair during the 80s, and she was now working full-time as my secretary. She was also one of the only people I wanted to have around me at this time. Somehow she understood my grief and was not afraid of it. It's amazing how many so-called friends disappear in the face of this kind of tragedy. She's a truly courageous person with tremendous compassion and a lifelong friend. I also felt I needed a complete change of scenery, so with Roger in tow, I drove around London looking at houses until I found a beautiful house in Chelsea, set back off the road on a side street. It was perfect. It had a courtyard to park in and a small walled garden. At the same time, with the help of Leo Hageman, a developer in Antigua, and Colin Peterson, his friend and architect, I set about designing and building a villa within the grounds of a small resort hotel on Galleon Beach in English Harbour, on the south coast of Antigua. What was I doing? I was running, in several directions at once. In fact, until Roger put a raging stop to it, I almost bought another country house, with the intention of selling Hurtwood altogether. Ostensibly, the London option made sense, the consensus being that I should be around people for a while, as Hurtwood had so many memories. As for Antigua, I had been going on holiday there for years and had brought Laurie and Connor there many times. English Harbour had a flourishing community of crazy people, and I felt like I fit right in. The governing factor in all of this, though, was motion. Keep moving. Under no circumstances stay still and feel the feelings. That would have been unbearable. I was 3 years sober, with just enough recovery to stay afloat, but no real experience or knowledge to be able to deal with grief on this scale. Many people might have thought it would be dangerous for me to be alone, that I would ultimately drink, but I had the fellowship, and I had my guitar. It was, as it always had been, my salvation. Over the next 2 or 3 months, in England and Antigua, I stayed alone, going to meetings and playing the guitar. At first I just played, with no objectives, then songs began to evolve. The first to take shape was "The Circus Left Town," about the night Connor and I went to the circus, our last night together. Later, in Antigua, I wrote a song linking the loss of Connor with the mystery surrounding the life of my father, called "My Father's Eyes." In it I tried to describe the parallel between looking into the eyes of my son and seeing the eyes of the father that I never met, through the chain of our blood. A few years later, in 1998, a Canadian journalist, Michael Wallachuk, took it upon himself to track down my real father, only to find out, when his search was done, that the man he was supposed to be, Edward Fryer, had died back in 1985. I suppose it shamed me into setting about a search of my own, or at least an attempt to authenticate his findings. I didn't get very far. The trail was muddy, and I was never convinced that this man was really my dad. At best, all I could do was verify what the reporter had already found out. All through my life, people had asked about my father to the point where I had taken an I-don't-want-to-know stance, just to close the subject. Consequently, I had always resisted any impulse to find out the real truth, and by the time I did try, it was, it seemed, too late. The most powerful of the new songs was "Tears in Heaven." Musically, I had always been haunted by Jimmy Cliff's song "Many Rivers to Cross," and wanted to borrow from that chord progression. But essentially I wrote this one to ask the question I had been asking myself ever since my grandfather had died. Will we really meet again? It's difficult to talk about these songs in depth. That's why they're songs. Their birth and development is what kept me alive through the darkest period of my life. When I try to take myself back to that time, to recall the terrible numbness that I lived in, I recoil in fear. I never want to go through anything like that again. Originally, these songs were never meant for publication or public consumption. They were just what I did to stop from going mad. I played them to myself over and over, constantly changing or refining them, until they were part of my being. Toward the end of my stay in Antigua, I chartered a boat for a 2-week trip around the islands with Roger and his wife. I've always loved being by or on the sea, and although I have no ambitions to be a sailor, I find the scale of the ocean very calming and revitalizing. The start of the trip, however, wasn't a great success. Roger and I were still at loggerheads over various things, and the atmosphere was chilly. Later we were joined first by Russ Teitelman, and then by Yvonne Kelly and my 6-year-old daughter, whom she had named Ruth. This lifted the mood, and the cruise took an upward turn. Among the letters that had come in about Connor was one from Yvonne, in which, to help me in my loss, she had offered me the opportunity to become fully acquainted with Ruth as her father. It was an incredibly generous act, and gave me some direction until the fog cleared. This little sea cruise was in fact the first of many small visitations that took place to test the waters for this idea, and it worked. It was great to be in the company of a child again. My child. I will always be grateful to Yvonne for giving me this second chance. It was a lifeline in a sea of bewilderment and confusion. Over the next couple of years I visited them in Montserrat, slowly establishing a rapport with my daughter until Yvonne decided that in order for Ruth to get a proper education and spend more time with me, they would come home to Doncaster, the Yorkshire town where Yvonne had been brought up. So far as helping me cope with the death of Connor, developing a relationship with Ruth was, at first, no more than a band-aid solution. It wasn't until the pity was taken out of the equation and we started to have fun that it became a real thing for me. It took time, because first I had a lot of work to do repairing myself, and until that was done, my ability to be emotionally intimate with my daughter was seriously limited. As for discipline, I had a lot to learn and was very unsure of my entitlements with her, but slowly, bit by bit, we got to know one another, and I learned, through therapy, how to express my disapproval when necessary. Looking back on those years, I realized what a profound effect she had on my well-being as a whole. Her presence in my life was absolutely vital to my recovery. In her I had again found something real to be concerned about, and that was very instrumental in my becoming an active human being again. In the early summer of 1991, I took a trip to New York to look at a film being made by Lily Zanuck, wife of the American movie producer Richard Zanuck. Called Rush, it is based on a true story about a female undercover narcotics agent who becomes an addict herself. Lily was a big fan and wanted me to do the score for the film. I'd never taken on an entire project like this before, most of the film work I had done up until then having been supervised by the American arranger and composer Michael Kamen. We had got together to do music for an English thriller TV series called Edge of Darkness, and then the Lethal Weapon films had followed from that. In all honesty, from what I had seen thus far, I had no great passion for the movie industry. I love film, and am a real movie buff, but being behind the scenes left me cold. Nevertheless, I took the job mainly because I liked Lily. She was outrageously funny, and I loved and identified with her views, be it on movies, music, or just life. At the end of the summer I took up residence in L.A. and started working on the film. Lily assigned a guy named Randy Kerber to be my assistant, and he was fantastic. He showed me the ropes and created beautiful musical pastiches for me to compose over. We were a great team, and I hope one day we can do it again. I remember at some point playing Tears in Heaven to Lily, and her insistence that we put it in the movie. I was very reluctant. After all, I was still unsure about whether or not it should ever be made public. But her argument was that it might in some way help somebody, and that got my vote. The song was released as a single, and was a massive hit, my only self-penned number one as far as I can remember. The film didn't do so well, although it deserved to. It was a controversial subject, and some scenes were quite harrowing to watch, but I thought it was sensitive and true to its purpose. It's since become something of a cult hit, and I'm extremely proud of the music. I finished up the year by touring Japan with George Harrison. He and Olivia had been really kind to me over the last few months, and I wanted to express my gratitude. During the trip, Laurie showed up out of the blue and just checked into our hotel. Her boyfriend Silvio had faxed me, warning me that she was coming to see me. They had broken up, and he was worried about her sanity. I couldn't handle it. I was barely holding myself together emotionally, and there was work to do. Curiously enough, George stepped in and took control. They travelled around together, and he seemed to have a calming influence on her. I felt very guilty about not being able to comfort her, but I was experiencing tremendous feelings of anger and sadness, with no real idea of how to cope with that and her at the same time. By Christmas, I had moved to London and was enjoying being back in Chelsea after a 20-year absence. The neighbourhood at the World's End hadn't really changed much at all, although King's Road east of the Town Hall was almost unrecognisable. In the 60s there had been literally only 3, maybe 4 boutiques in the whole of Chelsea, and now the Sloane Square end was wall to wall with clothing shops, mostly rubbish. But I loved being back, and pictured a new era of bachelorhood dawning. I still thought that diversion might be the solution for my grief, and that dating would take my mind off the loss of my son, as if it really worked like that. Part of the reason for moving into London was to stop myself from isolating, and to try and develop new friendships. Although London is a notoriously lonely town, I found within a few months that I had met and become friends with quite a few new people. My oldest friendships to this date, apart from my school friends, come from these days in Chelsea. Jack English, who is a great photographer, Chip Summers, who now runs a successful rehab counselling service called Focus 12, Paul Wasif, a great guitar player and counsellor, Emma Turner, who now works for Goldman Sachs and sits on the Crossroads board, and Richard and Chris Steele, who ran the rehab section of the London Priory Clinic for a number of years. Over the next decade in London, my life began to fill up with all kinds of interesting people, many of whom also happened to be in recovery. I also got a big kick out of watching Monster restore and furnish my new house with beautiful antiques, and, inspired by his passion, I started buying art for the walls. I had just stumbled onto the work of Sandro Chio and Carlo Maria Mariani, and began filling up the house with their canvases. It was the first time I had spent big money on art, and I remember showing Roger a Richter I just bought in an auction for £40,000. It was grey brush strokes from top to bottom. Roger couldn't believe it. I wish I had a picture of his face when I told him how much it cost. Over the next couple of years, I built up quite a respectable collection of contemporary painters, and became deeply interested in art all over again. The year 1991 was horrendous on the face of it, but some precious seeds were sown. My recovery from alcoholism had taken on a new meaning. Staying sober really was the most important thing in my life now, and had given me direction when I thought I had none. I had also been shown how fragile life really is, and strangely enough had somehow been cheered by this, as if my powerlessness had become a source of relief for me. The music, too, took on a new energy. I had a need to perform these new songs about my son, and I really believed that they were meant to help not just me, but anybody who had or would suffer such extraordinary loss. The opportunity to showcase them came in the guise of an unplugged TV show for MTV. I had been approached to do it and wasn't sure, but now it seemed like the ideal platform. I sat in my house in Chelsea and worked out a repertoire for the show that would allow me to really revisit my roots and present these new songs in a safe and careful environment. The show was great. Andy Fairweather Lowe and I did quite a lot of bare acoustic work on the Robert Johnson and Brunsey material, and we performed Tears in Heaven and Circus Left Town, although I later vetoed Circus on the grounds that it was too shaky. I also enjoyed going back and playing the old stuff like Nobody Knows You When You're Down and Out, which was how it had all started back in Kingston so long ago. Russ produced the album of the show, and Roger was like an expectant father hovering over the project, while I was fairly dismissive, saying that I thought we ought to put it out as a limited edition. I just wasn't that enamoured with it, and as much as I'd enjoyed playing all the songs, I didn't think it was that great to listen to. When it came out, it was the biggest-selling album of my entire career, which goes to show what I know about marketing. It was also the cheapest to produce, and required the least amount of preparation and work. But if you want to know what it actually cost me, go to Ripley and visit the grave of my son. I think that's also why it was such a popular record. I believe people wanted to show their support for me, and those who couldn't find any other way bought the album. The American summer tour that year, however, threw this particular phenomenon back in my face. Tears in Heaven was high on the charts, and I was trying to open the show with it in front of crowds of people who were screaming their heads off, with the result that I couldn't hear myself think, let alone play. I would come off stage every night heartbroken and angry that they weren't listening. I felt I couldn't do the song justice, and with no stagecraft to fall back on, I had absolutely no idea what to do about it. How do you tell 20,000 people to curb your enthusiasm? It was a no-win situation, but I eventually got audiences to calm down. I found that moving the acoustic songs to the middle of the set gave the fans a chance to settle down before the big hit was launched on them. The end of the year saw the birth of what has become an annual event for me, the New Year's Eve sober dance at the Leisure Centre in Woking. It had started the year before as a disco party in Merrow, suggested by my friend Danny, as a recourse for people who didn't want to drink on New Year's Eve. It was a great success and marked my first ever attempt at sober dancing. But when we held a post-mortem meeting the day after the dance, some bright spark asked why we couldn't have live music in the future, seeing as how we had such an abundance of talent in the fellowship. The dance has been going strong ever since, and I play every year, except in emergencies. I always look forward to it because it's fun, it's very relaxed, and I can play anything I want. On top of that, I know that it has also kept a few people from drinking, who otherwise would have succumbed to the pressure of the festivities. Meanwhile, my dating life was going full strength, but I was trying to restrict my attentions to women in recovery, the theory being that they would be safer or saner than my previous girlfriends. I obviously still had a lot to learn. One woman in particular had a profound effect on me. She lived in New York and was quite self-possessed, enough not to be manipulated by me anyhow. This manifested itself in her views on smoking, or at least my smoking. I was not allowed to smoke in her apartment, for one thing, and it made me very angry. But I liked her, and thought it might be going somewhere, so at a dinner party a few months later, when I was introduced to a hypnotherapist named Charlie, I took the plunge. I had been smoking heavily ever since my 21st birthday party, and now I was smoking at least 2 packs a day, sometimes 3. I went to see Charlie on a Monday morning on my way to rehearsals, and knew deep down that if I got to bed that night without a cigarette, then it was over. It was tough to begin with, and for the first month, from time to time, I did feel like I had taken some bad acid. Overall, however, I was beside myself with joy for having beaten such a disgusting addiction. I have spoken to hundreds of people since then about the way they gave up smoking, and have been quite astonished at how many of them still miss it. For myself, stopping smoking was like giving up alcohol. I have never missed it, and not even in the darkest moments of my life have I ever felt like lighting up a cigarette or taking a drink. Lucky fellow, you may say. But I really believe it is about spiritual application, no matter how poverty-stricken I feel my application may be. Could it be, then, that without nicotine in my system, I was emotionally vulnerable to the next woman who came along? Without a shadow of a doubt. That, coupled with the fact that she was quite fond of drugs and booze, was very vivacious, and was totally unavailable, made her probably the most dangerous woman I would ever meet, but it takes two, and I was in a very illusory period of my life. I was swollen with success and feeling very sure of myself, although just under the surface, there were caverns of grief that weren't really being dealt with at all. I was definitely heading for a fall. The woman in question was an Italian named Francesca. She was a fine-looking girl with dark hair and a slim, but at the same time voluptuous figure, with a face slightly reminiscent of Sophia Loren. Her mother worked for Giorgio Armani. Giorgio and I had become friends over the last few years, and I was seeing quite a lot of him, going to his shows and socializing. I think he's an amazing man, and a great designer, and I felt very proud and flattered that he would want to get to know me. When, through him, I was introduced to this young girl, I had no inkling of how much she would come to mean to me. I just thought she was interesting and refreshingly bright, that's all. Within months, I was on my knees. Our affair lasted 3 years, but at no time did we actually live together. I think it's important to acknowledge this because it should serve to illustrate how temporary and shaky the whole thing was. It would wobble along for a few days, and then the wheels would fall off and it would be back to square one again. Francesca was a Gemini, totally unpredictable and prone to violent outbursts of temper. On the other hand, she could be as sweet as honey and totally beguiling. The problem was you never knew which one you were going to get. I think we broke up 9 or 10 times in that whole period, and I was addicted to her throughout. Unhappy though I was, and despite the warnings of my friends who could see no future for me in this relationship, I went crawling back for more, time after time. One day, while I was entertaining my friends Chris and Richard Steele in Antigua, I confided in them about my troubles and showed Chris a letter I had written to Francesca to get her opinion. She looked at me as if I had landed from another planet. "Why are you giving this woman all your power?" she asked. I had no idea what she was talking about, but I was intrigued. Chris was at that time director of the Alcohol and Addiction Unit of the Priory Psychiatric Clinic in Roehampton, but I had heard that she also conducted one-on-one private counselling sessions. I asked if she would see me, and she said yes. For a while, I didn't really know what I was getting into. I thought that I could pick her brains to find ways to control Francesca, but I was to find myself going in a very different direction altogether. Chris's first question to me at our very first session was, "Tell me who you are." A very simple question, you would think, but I felt the blood rush up to my face and wanted to yell at her, "How dare you? Don't you know who I am?" Of course, I had no idea who I was, and I was ashamed to admit it. I wanted to appear that I was 10 years sober and fully mature, when in fact I was only 10 years old, emotionally speaking, and starting from scratch. Her attitude to the relationship was pretty novel, too. While everyone was saying get out and that the girl was no good for me, her view was that my troubles had nothing to do with Francesca. In fact, she liked her. What I needed to address, according to Chris, was what I was doing there in the first place. In short, her counsel was that I should stay there until either I'd had enough or learned whatever it was I needed to learn. The essence of this period of my life was that the recovery work I was doing balanced the chaos in my personal life. The crazier it got with Francesca, the deeper I delved into recovery, especially therapy. Along with Paul Wasif, a friend I had met through Francesca, I began doing peer support work at the Priory, which involved taking a short training course and, among other things, allowed us to sit in on group therapy sessions with clients at the beginning of their day. I loved it. It gave me a sense of real responsibility, and at times it was like living theatre. You never knew what would happen next, and the results could be extremely positive, sometimes miraculous. I also began working with a therapist who specialized in John Bradshaw's methods, in particular looking at family history as a guide to undoing present dysfunctional behavior. My mum and my uncle were definitely suitable cases for treatment, and my past was riddled with weird scenarios. No wonder I was living it all out again in the present. As much as I was engaged on a voyage of personal self-discovery, I was also rediscovering my roots. Having opened the door to my true musical tastes with Unplugged, I decided it was time to say thank you to the blues and to the players and singers who had inspired me so much throughout my life, people like Elmore James, Muddy Waters, Jimmy Rogers, and Robert Johnson. I went into the studio with the approach that everything would be recorded live. And having chosen the songs, we would play them as much like the original versions as possible, even down to the key they were played in. It was great fun, and I loved every minute of it. It was what I had always wanted to do. Unfortunately, Roger didn't agree. I think he felt that having scored so strongly with Unplugged, I was squandering a golden opportunity. I don't know what else he had in mind, I was too busy marching to my own drummer, but it marked the beginning of the end for us. My absorption with the blues project also blinded me to the whole revolution that was taking place in the English music scene. Britpop and DJs, jungle and drum and bass, it was all going on and I had no idea. Plus, from what I could gather from Francesca, who was deep into all of this, the culture was heavily fueled by ecstasy and various other designer drugs. I felt very much the same as when punk had burst onto the scene in the 80s, scared and threatened, because even though I didn't view myself as the establishment, I was fully aware that the punkers did. From the Cradle, my new album, did very well, going to the top of the charts in the States, which was pretty good for a no-frills blues record. I toured on the strength of this for nearly 2 years, playing nothing but the blues all over the world, blissfully unaware of the way the music industry was changing. While I was on the American leg of this tour, I got the call from Francesca telling me she had gone back to her old boyfriend, and that it was finally over between us. I was devastated, and poured my heart out to anyone who would listen, and by this time that list had got quite short. In fact, the whole weary business dragged on for another year, but the real heart had gone out of it for both of us. To give her credit, like Carla several years earlier, Francesca had tried to make it clear right from the start that she didn't really want a full-time relationship. I just didn't want to hear her. The end of the affair, when it finally came, coincided with an electrical fire in my London house, which seemed like an omen. I also saw it as an opportunity to wipe the slate clean and start again from scratch, so I emptied the house, sold all the contents, and began again. Now that Francesca was out of my life, I started to investigate the culture that she was so much a part of. I listened to everything I could get my hands on, and I woke up to what was happening with street fashion too, It was weird because a lot of it tied in with the old 50s and 60s street look that I had worn in the Yardbirds, Levi's and windbreakers, hoods and sneakers. But there was a new angle on it. I started looking at graffiti art and began collecting it. It was like a whole new world was opening up to me. The only problem was I felt I was too old to be getting into it. I hated the idea that I was this old guy trying to come across as a hip young street dude. But the culture was drawing me in. It was powerful, and I felt I understood it. What could I do? I was hooked again. I began designing things. I knew that if I was accepted as a designer, my age would be of next to no consequence. I met a couple of ex-skaters named Simon and William who had a head shop called Fly on King's Road, and we started a label called Choke. With me sharing most of the design duties, we made some very nice apparel for a couple of years, until the business end of it became unmanageable. Then, through Simon and his friend Michael Koppelman, I met Hiroshi Fujiwara, who had become a very close friend over the last few years. Hiroshi is a great designer, among other things, and a large influence in modern street culture. When I first met him, he was involved with the Good Enough label and starting some others. I also became very close to the graffiti writer Crash and bought a lot of his work. So Francesca, for all her obstreperousness, indirectly turned me on to a whole new lifestyle, and also, accidentally, was involved in the founding of Crossroads Antigua. Not bad for someone whom I literally wanted to strangle every time I saw her. Crossroads. One day, during the summer of 1994, I got word from her family that Alice, who had disappeared for a while in France, had shown up again in England and was seriously ill in a hospital in Shrewsbury. This didn't come as a great surprise to me, since over the years I'd heard that she was still getting pretty messed up. Now that I knew where she was and that she appeared to have hit rock bottom, it occurred to me that it might be the right time to try and get her some help. I talked to Chris and Richard about her, knowing how good they were at dealing with situations like this, and they very kindly went up to see her and talked her into coming back to the Priory with them. Because of our past together, it was considered ethically inappropriate for me to work with Alice in group therapy, but at one point Chris called me in to tell me that Alice still had a lot of anger as a result of our relationship. They needed to address this in order for her to move on, and had come to the conclusion that it would be beneficial for her to confront me with these feelings. They warned me that it could be quite a traumatic experience, but there would be a counselor present, and I felt I could handle it. When the day came, she ranted at me for about an hour without stopping, regurgitating all the scenarios from our fractured past with absolute clarity. It was terrifying to realize the damage I had done to this poor girl, but I had to stay silent and just absorb it. It was a humbling experience, and at times I could hardly believe the things she said that I had done. It was as if she were talking about somebody else. The saddest part for me was knowing that she had held on to all this poisonous stuff for over 20 years in order to fuel her need for oblivion. Alice stayed in the Priory for the entire course of treatment, and on a couple of occasions I bumped into her and asked how she was doing. "It's going great," she would say, so I was fairly hopeful. I knew it would take a long time once she got out of the clinic, and that she would have to find some employment or activity in order to regain her self-esteem, but the fact that she had stayed put was in itself a fantastic achievement. Next, I heard that she had gone into a halfway house in Bournemouth, a facility I'd visited once and remembered as being a really good place, so I was confident that she was making progress, and anticipated that she would soon be on the road to a full and complete recovery. I went off on tour to America, and the next time I saw Alice was at my grandmother's funeral. Though Rose had been ill for some years with emphysema, it was cancer that took her in the end. Her death, just before Christmas 1994, was a great blow to me. She'd always been the one constant figure in my life, encouraging me in all my endeavours, and loving me unconditionally to the very end. Her house was always a refuge, and at weekends, when I was home, it had become a tradition to go there for delicious Sunday lunches. Until my drinking kept us apart, we had had a wonderful life and some very funny times together. All in all, up until that point, she had been the single most influential person in my life. In the last few years, encouraged by Chris in my counselling sessions, I had spent a lot more time with both Rose and my mother in the hope that we could heal the wounds that had for so long prevailed in our collective relationship. My mother, in particular, was quite sick and had become fairly dependent on prescription drugs.